We Talk Podcasts is now proudly presented by Geek Nation Tours. The time of the geek is at hand. Geek Nation Tours provides fun and unique vacation packages featuring themes such as the Civil War, Harry Potter, board games and beer, sports geeks, in locations such as Germany, Japan, England, and all over America. Visit geeknationtours.com and get your geek on.
Heyo, welcome to a special episode of We Talk Music, and I'm joined today by Keith. How you doing, Keith?
Hi, Brett. Glad to join you on We Talk Music.
I know, there's a first time for everything, and also our extra special guest, musician extraordinaire David Berwald. How are you, David?
Well, I'm very well, thank you very much.
Thank you. So why don't you tell us about your new project coming up?
Well, it is going to be about 10 songs, cinematic in scope, tertiarily connected with, you know, picture a Pink Floyd record with Lou Reed.
Ooh.
Maybe a little heavier. I'm working with Dave Ricketts again, which is really exciting.
Literally getting the band back together.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're talking about possibly doing some shows now. And, you know, now, you know, our bass player is the head of bass at Musicians Institute, and our percussionist is the head of music at Cal Arts. So they're in town, you know, and so we may actually put that band back together again.
That's very exciting. I'm sure that there'll be a lot of fans that will be very excited for that.
I hope so. I hope there's at least 500 of them.
So you're putting this on Pledge Music. What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, you mean as opposed to Kickstarter or
even just a label? Going to a label, yeah.
You know, what I want to do is there's no label in the world that would want to pay for. You know, I mean, this is, you know, labels are in the mass market audience, you know. That's what they need to do in order to support their signing. So, you know, I really don't think that the core of the demographic of this album is going to be, you know, 14-year-old girls necessarily. Probably not.
So then, in that case, was there, like, Pledge Music obviously makes sense because it's a music one, but really,
yeah,
what?
Yeah, they just do music. They're very, they're very hands-on. They do a lot of research themselves, you know, in terms of how they can go about things. You know, it's a terrific group, and they're very hands-on with the artist. So far I've had a great experience with them. You know, we haven't started the campaign yet. We start that, I think, on Monday, whatever the 14th is.
Soon.
Yeah, very soon.
Yeah, it's like 2 or 3 days.
So at what stage are you at with the project?
Well, I've got, you know, listen, I mean, the way these things happen is you have to sketch and layer and sketch and layer. So what I have now is sketches. I have a lot of lyrics and quite a few musical sketches. This is the process where you actually, you know, where you take that sort of outline and make a whole record out of it.
So what is, for anybody interested, what is a musical sketch to you?
Usually it's a chord chart, a lyric, chord chart, some kind of basis of a groove, although that tends to evolve with the musicians that I bring in. Sometimes you write something as a waltz and it turns out to be some stomping metal tune. You can't really tell. But I try to keep them pretty simple. because they're, you know, that way they're more, you know, they're more changeable. You know, when you play a tune to people, they're going to hear them different ways. And if you play it too much in one particular style, then it can really lower everybody's participation.
So it's safe to say that you're not exactly dictating how the final song is truly going to sound to everybody who's going to be playing.
No. The idea, I mean, the reason this isn't just me sitting here playing acoustic guitars is because of that, you know. I wouldn't have them there if I didn't want their ideas. You know, that's important. It's important to have a coherent group, you know, feeling.
So how did it come up then with joining back up with David Ricketts for this?
Well, you know, we talk a lot. You know, we're old friends. And he had started working with Bernie Taupin, you know, Elton John's lyricist.
Yep.
And is one of my three sort of main influences, I think. They needed a singer, so they asked me, or Dave asked me to sing. And, you know, I was planning on doing this record anyway. And it, you know, just working with him on this stuff just cemented how much I enjoy it. And, you know, it probably is the best musical partnership I'll ever have.
So talk to us a little bit about Boomtown. What was kind of your mindset at the time? What went into recording that, and what went into, you know, what were your thoughts after with its success?
Well, I mean, you know, what made it, you know, what happened, you know, we just got together. David had gotten this Tascam 244 Porta Studio, which is this little four-track cassette recorder, and he really figured out how to make that thing sing. And you know, I'd met him. I met him when I think I was 17 years old. He was a sort of older guy from Philly who, you know, had serious musical chops. And I'd been sort of coming out of the punk rock scene. I'd been playing a lot of the clubs in punk bands. And, but, you know, I didn't really see punk as like this, you know, it just didn't really make sense for me ultimately. I like it. I still do, but, it just doesn't fit what I do really somehow. And, you know, I started working with Dave, and we, you know, we just found a very, very easy symbiotic working relationship. You know, our personalities and skill sets merged really well. And what was the second part of the question? I'm sorry.
Basically, well, about the success of the album, like how did you feel? And
well, you know, I mean, it was disorienting. It's inherently disorienting. You know, you start out doing something like this really, you know, for your own reasons and kind of in the dark, and, you know, there's no self-consciousness about what you're doing, because, you know, I don't think anybody's ever going to hear it. You know, and then you sort of, you know, you find yourself on television, you know, a lot, you know, then you become yourself the topic of conversation. And, you know, I think that's, you know, some people really thrive on that. It's not something that I'm really suited for, personally, that aspect of it.
Now, I want to stick with this album for a second. Now, you were mid-20s when you did this album, right?
Yeah, I was 24.
And there's some, like, cynical big city stuff. Like, Welcome to the Boomtown, Swallowed by the Cracks, All Alone in the Big City.
How did I arrive at such a middle-aged perspective?
Exactly.
Well, you know, I'd seen quite a bit by that time. I'd been on my own pretty much since I was 16. And you know, I'd seen quite a bit already by that time. I'd seen, you know, many, you know, people die and, you know, just a lot of stuff. So I guess I was jaded from an early age.
Well, maybe that's the opposite progression for a lot of artists. You start with the cynical, go to the lighter as your career went on.
Well, yeah, I hopefully so. although I just, so far, you know, there's quite a bit of darkness on this one too. But you know, yeah, I mean, hopefully one learns how to deal with things a little differently.
So, is there a kind of a catharsis in writing darker songs for you?
Yeah, there is. I mean, to me, it's payback, you know, from the situation. you know, I'll go anywhere, but in return, I get a song, you know.
So, was there any kind of thoughts in your mind of continuing on as David and David after Boomtown, just to kind of chase the success?
Oh, were we planning on doing that?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, of course. But, you know, circumstances intervened, you know. You know, to be honest, people ask me why we never did it. You know, I can't ever give anybody a decent answer. There really isn't one. It was just, you know, I guess we were just not very bright, you know. We both immediately sort of got, you know, went wandering off in different areas, you know.
But, in fairness, maybe it was for the best, because you went on to release amazing music, and in fairness, if you had stayed together, perhaps, you know, things would have gotten worse between you, and that would have been counterproductive in its own way.
Yeah, you know, and also, you know, like, you know, I think Boomtown is a really, really special record. And, you know, even for me, I hate everything. It's a special record. And, you know, we had a special kind of, I don't know, we didn't want to do something just to put it out, you know.
There's no sophomore curse. There's no sophomore album.
Exactly right. Exactly right. It's another way of, yeah, instead of getting, yeah, a failing grade in sophomore, you just don't come back to school.
Well, so then you released Bedtime Stories, and that definitely had a much different feel to it. It was definitely more stripped down.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to experiment more, sort of, you know, songwriting, American song, the American songbook, at least for that period. Although I wouldn't call that stripped. It's actually a lot less stripped down than Boomtown. Boomtown was just me and Dave.
Mm.
Bedtime Stories, there was Vinnie Colaiuta and Larry Klein and Joni Mitchell and the whole collection of great musicians.
I guess maybe for me it just felt like the actual lyrics were stripped down almost.
Oh, well, I was zeroing in. I mean, Boomtown, you know, what I was trying to do on some level was trying to do, you know, a sort of a trilogy in L.A. very loosely, you know. But so Boomtown is sort of more of an overview of the place. To me, Bedtime Stories was always about these two people, you know, in a deteriorating relationship in Venice Beach at that time. So I was trying to do something very specific about, you know, zoom into one couple rather than a whole bunch of people. And then Triage, of course, I went the opposite direction and tried to find all the fringe characters that I could as part of that same trilogy.
Now, Triage is where I first discovered your music. It's an incredibly striking album cover.
Yeah, I got a few striking from that record. Yeah, people responded strongly one way or another to that. Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's okay. that's but that was when I how I discovered it was I was working in a music store and that cover jumped out. And this is, it certainly Liberty Lies and Refugees is on Bedtime Stories, but you went a very political direction and a very different sound with Triage.
Yeah, again, I was trying to do something else. I mean, one tries to, doesn't like to repeat oneself. Bedtime Stories is a more kind of a domestic record, so it made more sense for it to be more sort of, songish. Triage is about, the destruction, disintegration of personalities. And as a result, I thought it should be more, more fractured itself, more disintegrating. So, I tried to push everything in on that record to the sort of point of destruction. Much to the chagrin of Bill Bottrell, who had to go into rehab afterwards.
It does have my all-time favorite song title, the God No Shotgun Hydrahead Octopus Blues.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, at that time one of the things that I don't even know how much of this to get into, but particularly after we'd had all the success with with Boomtown, so I found myself on a I had a certain amount of money and so I got entangled up with this kind of group of investigative reporters and then through them, these kind of sort of revolutionary types, a lot of them started hanging out at my place, and several of them died. Out of those conversations came a lot of the stuff that, and a lot of the things, a lot of times, like I'll write a song, it'll just be something somebody says and I just write it down and then write a song about it. And so that's where that came from. It was from a fellow, rest in peace, who was pursuing something he called the octopus.
Oh, go ahead, Keith.
Oh, no, you go ahead, Brett.
Okay, so, I mean, you've definitely lived an interesting life, and I guess that is one of the questions that I wanted to ask about your songwriting process and just how everything comes out. So is it just basically that concept of you hear something and then you say, I'm going to try to write a song about that?
A lot of times. Some people say stuff that comes to mind, or there's just, that you're just like, oh, that's a... I mean, a lot of times I don't do that, of course. I mean, not every song I write comes out of conversations, but I certainly try to keep my ear alert to them. And I try to be as true to people as possible. And a lot of times, one of the things I really believe in writing-wise is, you have to give your characters a spine, and then they give you the voice, the more I can inhabit them and let them actually speak through me, the happier I am as a writer. My ambition is to vanish, to disappear.
Do you save songs then, because they don't quite fit the mood of the album that you're working on?
Oh yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, there's something like 250 songs that's sitting in my computer that nobody will ever see. Yeah. I'm a bit of a pack rat that way, actually.
Yeah, at the at some point there'll be the unreleased archives.
After I'm dead, thank you.
There's other ways around that.
I don't think so.
My heart jumped my throat a bit when you said there's 250 songs that I'll never hear.
Inside, Keith is weeping.
Well, you know.
Not necessarily inside.
I'm sorry. I tend to be a disappointment to people.
So after Triage, you went through a period where you did a lot of collaboration. You did you wrote songs for other people. Was that a conscious choice, or was it just kind of how things happened?
Well, it was sort of, you know, it was both. You know, it started, you know, because we put together this Tuesday Music Club outfit, and then we did the Sheryl Crow record. You know, that you would think that that would be a good thing. You know, we were both on A&M Records. And, but instead of being, you know, it just, it turned into just the most horrible war you could imagine, which finally resulted in the record company saying, you know, we own your name, and, you know, unless you do what we want you to do, you know, we're just, you know, we're not funding any record. You can't do anything under your own name, really. So I had to, you know, I had a child coming, and, you know, there was a lot of stuff that I had to figure out. So I did need to start, you know, being a little bit more professional about the way I worked. And doing things like, you know, TV shows and movies and that kind of stuff.
Do you enjoy doing those kind of things now?
You know, it really depends. It really depends. It depends on the artist. It depends on the people around her, you know, or him. A lot of times it can be sort of frustrating. Just because, you know, you don't have final control over what's happening, or initial control either. You know, you're definitely there to get something done by somebody else's standards, which is interesting. You know, it's nice to know what people like. You know.
So, have you got any good stories from Hurley Burley?
It was a wonderful experience. You know, I put together this great ensemble of guys and women, people. It was a movie that didn't, you know, that didn't really want music. I mean, the director did, but the playwright was David Rabe. He's a brilliant guy, and like most playwrights, you know, doesn't really believe in score. You know, it's just kind of foreign to them. It's like, why do we want, you know, my words say it, you know? And so there was a lot of push and give and take on that. But it was a great group of people, and it was really fun to do. A lot of the music didn't actually go in the film, just because David just really didn't want music in that film. But it still was a great time.
Right around this time, there was also one of the odder little stray tracks of yours in Reality Bites.
I'm nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did your words end up in Ethan Hawke's mouth, I guess is the question.
I was doing a lot of, you know, contract writing for people in those days. And, you know, one of the benefits or problems of the way that I've learned how to work over the years is that, I am able to internalize people, you know. So, I mean, you know, a lot of times a theatrical film producer would come to me because they know that I can write what their character would think and say, because that's how I roll, you know. The music supervisor on that was somebody that I'd worked with a lot named Karen Rackman. And she, you know, and that was a pretty easy one. It was like a slacker ballad. I was a bit of a slacker ballader myself. So, I mean, it wasn't a huge stretch. I mean, I've done a lot huger stretches. But yeah, and actually, I think that was one of the first, it was one of the first ones I did like that. Yeah, that was, I don't remember exactly, but yeah, I'm nothing. Actually, I like that song too.
So speaking of huge stretches, then what are some of the songs that you would consider the biggest stretches for you?
Ah, oh, geez. I mean, orchestral Japanese music for the Yoshida brothers, that's pretty extreme. Come What May, that was a bit, that was a stretch for me, from Moulin Rouge. I'd never written, you know, that unrestrainedly.
It is very much, much so.
Well, I mean, that was definitely an intellectual exercise. I wasn't at a particularly romantic spot in my life, and in fact, quite the contrary. And you know, basically, I just, you know, I sat up. The way I did that one is I sat up all night the night before reading Shakespeare's sonnets, you know, and just pretending that I like had some kind of like feeling like that. And then it was just, I was just blocking it out chord by chord. You know, it's painful. You know, a lot of times I keep a microcassette running when I'm writing something, because that way you don't, you know, you can sort of go off. You don't have to worry about forgetting stuff. And I got sued over that song years later. And so I had to find the actual writing tapes, and I listened to it, and it's like 3 hours. And I'm just, you can tell I'm just like, I sound like a guy punching a clock. I mean, it's like, I'm just sitting there, like, okay, come on, you know. But, you know, it was, I think it was like $50,000, you know. And like I said, children, they need their shoesies.
Yeah, that is true. That song was performed by a lot of people. Is there any performances of that song that you maybe think are the most spectacular, or, and perhaps on the other side, any that you think are completely off the mark?
You know, listen, I'm the wrong guy to ask, because, you know, to me, you know, the song I gave Baz was a very moderate waltz, you know. It, you know, I was really surprised to see when they did it. You know, Karen, it's kind of the same music supervisor, Karen Rackman, and she said, oh, you got to come see this, you know. And so I go over to her house, and it's like, you know, there's people shooting, and there's midgets, and people, you know, exploding and falling off of things, and I'm just like, wow, this is unbelievable. Who would have thought? But, you know, to be honest, I like the very humble kind of, you know, either a vocal and piano or vocal and guitar version of that song. Actually, there was this group, I think they called themselves Celtic Tenors or something, and they did a version of it that was beautiful, and it was just them and, I think it was the Irish harp, and it was beautiful. Just really simple. It's supposed to be a very simple song, you know. I was thinking of it more as something you'd whisper into somebody's ear rather than bellow at a crowd through a megaphone. But, you know, that was the movie.
Did you have a lot of interaction with Baz on that, or?
You know, on the telephone, yeah. He invited me to Australia, but... I had just had a kid, and there was just no way I was leaving town. I wish I'd gone, actually. I did meet everybody at the, you know, awards shows. That was, but I'd only spoken to Baz on the phone prior to that.
Yeah, because it definitely, you know, going through your career, it definitely seems, because of how over the top it is, it seems out of place for you. But you know, when you put it into context like that, it all makes sense.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like, what is it? You know, Supermodel. People are surprised that I wrote that. You know, that would, it's not necessarily what you would think of if you know me, you know. But I mean, you wouldn't believe all that kind of stuff. I've written Christian anthems. Got teen pop. I mean, you know. I remember one time I got this call from Larry Klein. It was like 9 o'clock at night, and he says, hey, you know, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm going to bed. And he said, well, I'm over at Capitol. I had kind of an issue. Can you come over? And I was like, okay. I lived very close to Capitol Records at that time. And I go over there, and, you know, no shit, Larry. There was like 40, 50 musicians there. Background singers, horn section, string players, you know, two full bands, Jay Maskus from Dinosaur Jr. And there was this, it was for a film, and there was, they needed a song for a girl who's 16, who's lesbian, who needs a song to sing to her girlfriend so that her girlfriend knows that she loves her, but that the record company doesn't know what it's about. and I had like 45 minutes. He's like, okay, you got 45 minutes, because then all the musicians are going to have to go on triple scale. And it had to be really long, too. It was this insanely long scene. You know, it's like twice as long as a normal song. And, you know, and there was no place. You know, Capitol Records is a pretty big studio, but there was so many people there. There was no place I could go where there weren't a whole bunch of people shouting at each other. And so I ended up writing the song surrounded by background vocalists and horn section people who were watching worldwide wrestling at like ear-splitting volumes. And I was just sitting there in the cafeteria or at this counter and wrote it. And, you know, I brought it downstairs and I said, you know, I don't know if this is, you know, and Larry said, well, let's check it out. And then I sang it and he just died. I was singing it out in the studio. And I look over and all I see are legs. And Larry had actually fallen on the floor. He was laughing so hard. And they loved it. So it went in the movie and it turned out to be, you know, a good thing.
That's awesome. That
was when I kind of felt like I'd earned my spurs as like a total hack, you know.
You could go with hired gun there.
Well, I mean, believe me, you know, listen, there was a certain amount of pride in there, because I can't think of many people that could have done it, you know. I can think of maybe two or three people in town that I know that could possibly have had a chance of pulling that off. So, on a kind of professional, like, you know, I don't know, jump through hoops kind of a thing, I was pretty... And it's actually a pretty good song. It's called My Secret Love. It was in this movie called Grace of My Heart.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely search that one out. I'm sure, Keith, you've already got it.
I'm scribbling it down now.
So let's...
It was a neat project. There was Elvis Costello was involved in it, and Burt Bacharach, Jerry Goffin, Joni Mitchell, a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, you've done a couple of things now with Joni Mitchell, so.
Yeah, we were very good friends for quite a few years. Very close.
So let's talk about Fine Mess.
Mm.
So that's because I know that that Keith got that one from the fan club website.
Oh wow!
And so that was that's an interesting way of releasing. Like, how did all that come about?
Well, you know, I'd been sort of just occupied being a professional idiot, and my mom was searching the internet for family members, and she found this website, and you know, there was all these people, and they were talking about what I do and stuff. And you know, I was sitting on a whole bunch of stuff anyway, which you know, I don't know how much to go into, but you know, anyway, a good friend of my son had died, and I'd sort of thrown this you know, kind of musical wake in a sense. You know, I just sort of locked myself in the studio with a bunch of buddies, and we just sort of, you know, played like Irishmen, you know, until we stopped thinking about the whole thing, until I stopped thinking about the whole thing. You know, it was really gruesome. And about then my mother had found these things, and I was like, well, why don't we just give it to him, you know? So we found a way of packaging it, which I still love, and just put them together, you know, without too much, you know, we just sold them there, you know, they went really fast. We made 500 of them. In fact, we're about to do that again. 25-year anniversary.
Oh wow!
We're gonna do another run of 500.
Oh my god! I can't believe it's been that.
Yeah.
Well, I think it has been. Yeah, I think it was 99.
Yeah, that's what.
Yeah, December 99. Yeah, I got it. Yep, info source open in front of me here.
Yeah, so 25 years ago. Yeah, my son is actually the record company on this one. He's putting it out.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, and
needs a car.
Is that like so you're paying him to be him twice kind of thing
Well,
for
no, basically it's like, okay, you want a car? Well, car will work for the damn thing, you know. So he's in charge of contacting people, and you know, I mean, I'm helping him get this stuff fabricated and stuff, but it's his first entrepreneurial position. And
Welcome to the family business. You have to burn some CDs.
Well, no, it's a hell of a lot more work than that. You know, it's a lot of work actually making these things. There, you know, there's the booklet, there's the cardboard, there's the packets that the CDs fit in. You got to get the CDs made, then each one has to be stamped and numbered, then he's got to give it to me to sign. So he's, you know, he's going to work for it.
Is that going to go through InfoSource, or is it going to go through another
You know,
stream?
I don't know that it's going to go through anything really. I mean, I think it's, you know, we're just going to pass the word around. I mean, there's only going to be 500 of them, you know. And there was a lot of demand for the, you know, after the fact, they were, you know, they were going for as much as like $300 on eBay. Because, you know, I mean, it's actually, you know, it's something I very much believe in general is handmade goods, you know. That's what I want. I mean, I really don't care about mass-produced things, you know. If it doesn't have the stamp of the artist himself on it or herself on it, it's just I can't be that interested in it. I like things that are just things, you know. I like cardboard and metal.
Good solid album title right there.
Yeah, some people like, you know, some people like Cadillac. No, I like things that, you know, and I also like things that aren't made for the mass market. You know, if it's made for the mass market, it means you're basically, you know, you're aiming for the stupidest people in the world. Yeah, I'd rather not write for that, you know, or even go there, you know.
Yes, you don't have the Walmart release planned.
No, it's just, you know, it's just, you're just asking for trouble. And so I overcharge less people. That's my plan. But you can feel special.
Well, I'll tell you what, you let me know when that's coming out, and I will happily be overcharged for
Well,
that.
everything's $20, no matter what it is. That's the idea.
All right, well, you will have my $20 when that is out.
Fantastic, and hopefully 10 friends of yours will. I mean, this record that we're trying to raise funds for is it's a pretty ambitious project, you know. A couple of guys from the Nine Inch Nails crew, or Dave Ricketts, Blake Mills, Matt Chamberlain, Russ Kunkel. You know, I'm relying heavily on some extremely talented people, and you know, that's gonna, I think people will be happy that I did. But it's going to take some doing to get there. Because, you know, the trouble is, I would say, oh, come on, just do it for a favor. And the trouble is, if you ask people to do something for a favor, you can't yell at them, you know? You can't give them a hard time. You can give them cupcakes, you know? You can't gauge, that was fucking terrible. You can't say that to somebody doing you a favor.
Yeah, it
You
really
missed the
throws the whole
spot.
production model out of whack. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, how you're going to stand there with jackboots and a whip if people are just coming over as friends.
There's a big gap between Here Comes the New Folk Underground and this new album. Was there a what made you, especially with the new album, decide that now was the time to release a new album?
Well, it kind of told me, you know, I mean, you know, it's always something in the back of my mind, you know. You know, should I make a record? Should I try to, you know, it really is just, I think it's time, you know, it's just, you know, basically, you know, you think about these things and, you know, there's like a clock assembling in your head at its own pace. And you can tell when it's not ready because it's still making funny noises. but then all the gears click into place and you go, oh, I know what to do. And then it's just a matter of doing it. Which sometimes, you know, sometimes it's as easy as sitting down with an acoustic guitar and doing it. And sometimes it's like, oh no, I've got to assemble a friggin' army, which is the case of this one. So, you know, I don't want to make one of these sort of, I don't want to make a humble record this time out. This is, I want to make an extremely aggressive and forceful and well-conceived and well-executed and well-engineered performance.
So would you, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, it just means professionals. It just means I need help, you know.
Yeah. Would you consider that a difference between the new album and Here Comes the New Folk Underground? What was behind the New Folk Underground?
The New Folk Underground was like, you know, I mean, to me, that was sort of an anomaly in and of itself. It, you know, sometimes I'll have an idea, I'll say, like, and that my particular idea that week or that month was, geez, I wonder what would happen if you tried to mix, like, the OJs and the Stanley Brothers. You know, it's a completely insane idea, but, you know, you have Oakland R&B, and then you have, you know, Appalachian foot-stomping music. It's very hard to, like, but, you know, but what to me, what they both had in common was more of an attitude, a spiritual attitude of just, you know, hey, life is difficult, and, you know, so let's whistle a tune. And so I was trying to find a musical bridge between those two, to me, very similar philosophies, even though, you know, if you took a bunch of Appalachian crackers and dropped them in Oakland, you know, they'd probably, there probably would be more than words exchanged between the two groups. So that was sort of like an experiment. It was, you know, it was also just a result of the fact that I was just so overwhelmed with grief at that particular time. And, you know, the people that showed up were my friends rather than, oh, well, I'm going to get the very best drummer. I don't mean to single out the drummer, but that wasn't really the point. It was just like, here, let's get together. Let's, you know, sing some simple songs that aren't complicated to learn. And you know, have a little sense of community and mourning and, you know, just kind of get through it with a smile on.
So did you have ready access to a studio, or were you doing that at home? How were you?
I lived in a studio. I had a 4,000 square foot brick building, and it was this, you know, it had a Neve mix desk in it and a pair of 24-track tape machines and every kind of mic you can shake a finger at, and you know, it was a full service recording studio with a bedroom.
Perfect.
As all the exactly. Best ones do.
Yeah,
exactly.
So I mean, a lot has changed in the industry since 1986 when Boomtown came out. How have things changed for you in that regard with recording and producing and all the like?
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention that because, well, it, you know, there's a bunch of, you know, the way I really like to do commercial music, I really like the way we did it with Sheryl Crow, you know, which is, you know, you had, or the way they did it with Stax Records, or, you know, where there's people that are there, you know, you go to a studio and there's a drummer there and you say, well, let's try this, you know, and then without having to think about, oh, well, I'm going to program this and, oh, shit, now I'm in programming hell. You have a great drummer sitting there and then you have a great rhythm track, and if you've got a decent idea, then, you know, that's how, like, all of my favorite records were made, you know. Be they band records or these studio band records, which I would be more, you know, like the Motown group or the Stax or, Muscle Shoals, where they're there, you know, and there's a human interaction and there's discussion. To me, this is a social medium, you know, it's a medium of exchange, of ideas, of energy, of personality, of, you know, body odor, whatever, you know, and and the notion that, you know, that we should all sit in our little master labs and inflict some kind of drum groove with somebody repeating some stupid shit over and over again, you know, that's not an exchange. That's not what I bargained for. You know, if I wanted to do that, I would have gone into advertising, you know.
I can only imagine some of your campaigns.
Oh, I did. I did. You know, I did the Lotus 1-2-3. It was huge. It ran forever. It's like bong, gong, gong, gong. Like, yeah, the director of the commercial said, "Well, what is all this Lotus 1-2-3 software make you feel?" I said, "It makes me feel terrified." And he said, "Okay, we'll do that." And so it's this terrifying fascist theme, you know.
No cupcakes for you.
Exactly right. No. Well, no, but they liked it, you know. I think maybe they wanted to scare people. I don't know.
Must be the secret to their continued success.
Yeah.
I don't even know if they're still around. It was huge, though, when they were around. They were like the, whatever it was they did, I don't know, database. I don't know.
Well. So any plans on going out on tour for the new album?
Well, you know, I'm very open to the idea. I mean, a tour, you know, shows, certainly. Yeah, I mean, listen. I'm very open to the idea. Particularly if David is up for it, that would be fun for me. That would make sense. Going out on these kind of things on your own is just misery.
I guess there's one question we didn't ask at the beginning that now I'm very curious. Is it going to be called David and David?
You know, I don't know yet. I mean, that's an evolving platform, and that really, you know, we're working together every week now, but we're still working on the Bernie Taupin stuff, and we haven't started on any of the new material. So, I'm hoping. We're both very, you know, the joke about us is, you know, I'm paranoid and he's agoraphobic, so, you know, yeah, let's start a band. that's the joke. And true,
especially if you can get in a room with 500 people.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Well, I mean, what we're talking about doing is actually our 30-year reunion is coming up. So we were talking about doing a show at the Roxy. You know, hopefully, as a party and a celebration, but also partly, hopefully, as a means of raising funds for this record.
All right. Well, Keith, we have to do some traveling next year.
Yeah, you still have that couch at the studio we can crash on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a different house, but no, I've got a couple of nice couches.
All right, we're in.
All right. Well, thanks, gentlemen.
So, well, actually, one of the last questions I'll ask is just. What are some of the interesting things that you have that, because I mean, with Pledge Music, there's different things that you offer. So I'm wondering if you can give us a snapshot of what some of those would be for your.
Oh, God, there's great ones. I mean, they range from the usual, you know, but for a staggering sum, I will write your life story in a corrida, in a Mexican corrida.
Wow.
Like a narco corrida. I have a book, a beautiful 19th century book of Oriental art that has a beautiful bullet hole in it that was fired by Sean Penn, who's going to sign it and autograph it. he wasn't getting enough attention at a party, and he shot up a pistol. And there's a tour that I'll take you on, my patented Tale of Two Cities journey through Los Angeles in the company of a 30-year veteran of LAPD homicide. So some lucky soul will have a whole day of meals and, you know, he'll see a side of LA that nobody's ever seen except for people like me and policemen. People love this trip. people. I've taken several foreign visitors on this particular trip, and all of them have said that it's changed their lives.
Well, I mean, that sounds fantastic.
We're doing some large sculpture pieces and some smaller sculpture pieces as well. In fact, even as we speak, a friend of mine is traveling around Wyoming and Montana and places like that looking for pieces of steel that we're going to turn into these, you know, he finds all these rusted pieces of sheet metal and old, you know, Coca-Cola signs from an abandoned gas station in the middle of nowhere, and he just grabs the stuff and then you know, we kind of work with them here. So we'll be selling those. I don't have the list in front of me, but yeah, I mean, you know, they changed, you know, they've, there's also a lot of, participation, you know, I'll be doing, video casts and stuff, keeping people apprised of what their investment is, how their investment is coming. And, you know, and they give them an opportunity to meet all the people that are involved and just kind of see what kind of stuff goes on. I mean, one of the fellows is a guy named Alessandro Cortini, who's one of the Nine Inch Nails guys, and he has this incredible modular synthesizer setup. And, you know, and he's also a really engaging person. You know, he's cute. People dig him. He's a genius, you know. That's why I care about him. But, you know, I think he photographs well. I think people will enjoy it.
Start putting him on the album covers.
Yeah. Well, I thought maybe I'd put like early 70s Fabio on the record cover. Maybe that would be good.
Oh, look, this looks like a romance book from Harlequin. Yeah.
Exactly, right. No, it's the collected false recollections of Bill O'Reilly.
Well, why don't you take a moment, Keith? Do you have any last questions?
I'm just gonna wrap up with it's quite an amazing world we live in when we can actually get into contact with you know, our favorite creators, musicians, etc. I've dropped you a couple of notes over the years, David, just because your music's meant a lot to me, and you know, whenever you've popped up on Facebook or Twitter, I've made sure to say thank you, but you don't often get to say thank you in person. So,
well, thank you very much for that. That's kind of what I live for in a way, you know. You know, I mean, when one operates in such a, you know, kind of shadowy field as I have, you know, it's nice to know that one's work has, you know, a positive effect in people's lives.
Absolutely. So why don't you plug whatever you want to plug, and then we will say goodbye.
Well, there's three things I'd like to plug. You know, one obviously is this record that I'm about to start, which I really need people's help on. I mean, it's much more ambitious than I could do alone. But also, you know, a publishing company is publishing all of my lyrics in a bound collection with introductions by some notable people, and that's called A Stain Upon the Silence. And I would really be just chuffed if people would pick that up. They're going to actually start teaching it, I think, at Cal State Northridge, or using it as part of their teaching. That's about that, I guess. And then there's also my son's project of a fine mess. I mean,
When's the book out, David?
We're waiting for Greil Marcus to write his thing, and also for Sean Penn, who's writing this thing. You know, he knows more of my lyrics than I do, and apparently he's used them to seduce women. I don't, you know, I probably shouldn't say that. So he feels he owes me on that score. He's talking Christy Turlington into bed or whatever.
That seems a fair trade for you, Dan.
Yeah, you know, exactly. I mean, God damn, it's the least he could do.
Yeah, that's another feather in your cap. Yeah, my lyrics got Christy Turlington into bed. Yes.
Well, I don't know if it's Christy Turlington. It was just, you know, a Jill, you know, just pick a gorgeous, famous supermodel. And
yeah. Unfortunately, it wasn't you, but.
Exactly. Well, you know what to do if you ever, you know, just start quoting Beerwald, and just apparently it just works like crazy.
Awesome.
Probably doesn't hurt to be Sean Penn either, but
there's that. There's
that probably doesn't. Yeah, that doesn't hurt your chances.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, David Beerwald, you are a fantastic artist and a fantastic guest, and I appreciate
well, you
coming
much.
On the show.
Thank you very, very much.
And I'll tell you what, if you ever wind up in Calgary, then I'll be more than happy to take you on a car tour of the, well, that will be probably nowhere near as interesting as your LA tour, but I'd be more than happy to take you on a tour.
Well, I'm going to take you up on it.
Awesome.
All right.
Thanks so much, David.
Okay,
and
bye-bye.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Streak and a lot of bodies unburied, and there comes a time you cannot turn the other cheek. You have got to ride the ferry past the faded old bodies of dead, dead dreamers, past the tethered and fitted in disband schemers, past the punks and the drunks and the bad guitar players and the dewy-eyed Cheers.